Esther 2, verse, beginning of verse 15. Now in the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her for his daughter, was come to go in unto the king, she required nothing but what Haggai, the king's chamberlain, the keeper of the women, appointed. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all them that looked upon her. So Esther was taken unto King Ahasuerus in his house royal in the 10th month, which is the month Tibeth, in the 7th year of his reign. And the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Mordecai, we know from the previous verses, was brooding over the providence of God. He's awaiting its full issue. He's engaged in a walking back and forth that reminds one of a brooding hen. And as he does so, he demonstrates his deep care and concern for the well-being of Esther. And through her, the deep care and concern for the well-being of all of the people of God. Though he is not able to be with her, that does not mean that he cannot offer her the benefits of his prayers. But he wants some information. He needs to know something about her estate. And so he waits. He's desirous of any bit of information, any crumb that might drop from the house where the harem was kept. It's important that he's attentive to this because we know that Mordecai is a righteous man, and we know that the effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. Now in this, Paul models the actions of this righteous man Mordecai when he seeks to know of the circumstances of those Christians whom have received the benefits of his ministry. Ephesians 6:22, he says, "Whom I have sent unto you for the same purpose, that you might know our affairs, and that he might comfort your hearts." There is, in fact, this idea of a communing between them, though they're separated by some distance. The people of God are joined by covenant bonds and have and should exercise a mutual and joint concern, care for the well-being of one another. So Paul is very much like Mordecai. Mordecai, in fact, is a good example then of a righteous man in his conduct, especially in uncertain times. Remember that the Persian Empire stretched out over a vast territory of some 127 provinces. It was the largest empire up to its time. And it was a time of ascendance when the whole world wondered after the beast. No one of any import in the world was exempted from its grip at this time. No one, including the people of God, the Jews. Now consider the voluptuousness of the pageantry of which we've read in the previous verses. Persia, India, and many of the provinces encompassed within this empire were actually noted for their perfumes and their aromatic oils. So there's a harem that's been assembled for the king with the goal of finding a new queen. All of the Gentiles have been caught up in the excitement. Think of the possibilities. You know, they didn't have the kind of turmoil that we have in a lot of Western countries where we have democratic elections. something like this was unusual. It was an event to be celebrated. It brought with it, undoubtedly, it brought excitement. And the notion that some girl from somewhere in this vast empire could become queen, well, that just added to the excitement. Within the harem, the women are preening and cleaning themselves. They're oiling and toiling over themselves. And they're spending themselves in their effort to gain the crown. There's been some archaeological evidence that what they would do with these perfumes and aromatic oils, that they had little burners. They used to think they were incense burners, but now they think that perhaps what they were actually burners, where they would put these aromatic oils, and so these women would bask in clouds of smoke from these aromatic oils, so that over time, and remember, they're doing this for 12 months, everything about them takes on the smell, the odor of these aromatics that they're using. It was the original aromatherapy. In all of this, we see the excess of the heathen. Here's a 12-month interval in which these aromatics are being consumed with what we can only, I think, describe as a hedonistic excess. But you see, there is this problem with pleasure. Pleasures actually cease to be pleasurable when they are pursued with such an effort as to make them weariness to the flesh. Yet from their banqueting to this vast beauty contest for queen, everything that we know and everything that we're told in the beginning of the book of Esther about this Persian empire cries out to us, this is an empire of excess. This is an empire filled with overindulgences. And the success and the overindulgences we've seen has already brought them to confusion. It's led them to bad counsel at home and abroad. From the campaign against Greece to the house of the king. This excess, this overindulgence, is contrary to the various warnings we have in Scripture, which tell us that moderation in all things brings with it the greatest pleasure while avoiding many occasions to sin. The Persian Empire stands as a stark example of what happens when people are consumed with excess. When people learn to live in luxury without any regard to anything but their material pleasures. Here we have a picture then of the beastly Persian Empire growing more and more decadent and debauched. And all these women who are deemed most eligible to replace the queen, they are themselves portrayed to us as participants in this decadence. In fact, as noted in chapter 1, the Jews themselves were often caught up in the feast of the flesh that was centered in the palace at Shushan. Evil communications corrupt good manners. The company we keep very often determines the actions that we take and the thoughts that we have. Seldom do even the people of God avoid being polluted by their circumstances. But now, with the fate of the people of God in the jaws of the beast, we are told that God has raised up Mordecai and now Esther to rescue the people against all odds. The end of these virgins, as they cycled throughout the palace night after night, was very dismal, if we think about it. Only one could possibly gain the crown. There's no win, place, and show. There's no first, second, and third. There's only first place. You get the crown, but for all intents and purposes, you go home in last place. And your home, if you go home in last place, is that second house of women. For the rest, if they don't gain the crown, the rest are consigned to what I called before a gilded cage. They're going to be locked up in this second house of women for the rest of their lives. Concubines, secondary wives, probably never again to visit the king. Perhaps one or two. Perhaps maybe a couple more than that, but not many out of the hundreds that have cycled through will ever see the king again. And yet all of them will be captive to his will for the rest of their lives. And they will be captive to his will in a way that far exceeds the rest of the people in the empire. Now, in an empire like this, the will of the sovereign is law. Rex lex. The king is law. But it was very hard to enforce that law in the furthest outposts in the empire. The further away you get from the palace, the harder it's going to be to enforce the will of the king. But in this second house of women, the iron will of the king would be felt in everything they did. So despite the jewels, the luxurious clothing, the comforts that surrounded them while they're in the harem, becoming a concubine was hardly enviable, except for the most shallow and materialistic mind. Better, as one commentator has noted on this, better it was to be the wife of a peasant than to be the concubine of a king. And yet, how many women are there today who are trained and have trained themselves to seek all of the things guaranteed to the concubine of the king, rather than suffer the perceived indignity or discomfort of being the wife of a peasant with all the hardships that it might bring in this life? So verse 15. Now when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her for his daughter, was come to go in unto the king, she required nothing but what Haggai the king's chamberlain, the keeper of the women, appointed. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all them that looked upon her. Now in the turn of Esther, this is an interesting phrase, because we're reminded that one by one, these women had gone in unto the king, and each of them had gone out as well. It was a revolving door. This heathen king, awash in a sea of beautiful women, was impressed by nothing that he saw. They would come in one door and go out the other. The fact is this, when everything is beautiful, nothing is really beautiful. You know, if everything is light, then you really don't see anything. You need shadows. We need contrasts in order for us to perceive differences. And this becomes a problem, I think, for the king. It's literally indistinguishable beauty from indistinguishable beauty. Night after night, with nothing that really makes one to differ from another. You see, anything, as I said before, anything beyond moderation actually tends to have diminishing returns for our comfort and pleasure. And this is the problem the king is having here. This is also, I think, why the prevalence and widespread use of pornography in our society has had such a degrading effect on women. It carries with it the illusion of making numerous women available to men, which, when coupled with widespread promiscuity, really does reduce women to pieces of meat rather than persons of unique worth and value. And so here the cycle of women proceeds at a rate which reduces each one, despite their physical beauty, each one is reduced to a lump of indistinguishable choices out of which this heathen king has concluded none seem worthy of elevation to queen. None. Now remember, too, that each one of these women had actually availed herself of the liberty of excess that was provided for her in the harem. And while she was there, she was able to attend to all of her wants and needs. Anything that could possibly be needed by her to contribute from the point of view of vain, shallow, worldly, materialistic, outward-focused people, all of that was available to her. And each one had presumed, with the help of her maidens, probably, when women get together, they presumed that they had some idea of what the king had wanted. Like they all thought they knew. And undoubtedly, always, it was colored by the vanity and shallowness which attaches to ungodly women who spend their lives seeking nothing more than the attention of men. They think they know what men want. They think they understand what men want. But they never will really achieve satisfying any man as long as their focus is simply upon the outward, the materialistic, the sensual. No one on either side of that equation. This is why promiscuity has become as such a destructive force in our society. Now the Hebrew phrase that's used here is very interesting. I think it's almost poetic in its turn of phrase, because it actually says here something more like this, that Esther's turn touched her. Now perhaps this language is used once more to point to the secret providence of God, which is working now efficaciously on behalf of the people of God. We don't see it outwardly, but we know, as I said, and we see again and again, the outworkings of this providence. These things are falling out at a rate that defies the odds. Right. This is, again and again, we see things come to pass which just cannot be coincidental. The point, I think, is, the text here, is that all of the preceding women vanish, as it were, into an obscure cloud of anonymity. Whilst our text is calling attention to our heroine, Esther. And so she's the only one whose name we even know. She's the only one whose character we care anything about. The remainder of these women, they all belong to a great sea of vanity whose waves wash in for a night and recede into the mists of time, never to be heard from again. And when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abigail. I think the next two clauses here are very interesting. You know, that as Esther prepares to enter into the chambers of King Ahasuerus, we have her genealogy, in a sense, being recounted very briefly here. We're reminded of her pedigree. You know, she's, of course, a Jewess. But now we find out that she's the daughter of one who bore the name of a Levite associated with the tabernacle. If you look at Numbers 3:35, Abihail. And her father's name, Abihail, literally means "my father is strength." This is a lineage worthy of reflection before she steps into the darkness of Persian heathenism, as she goes deeper into the belly of the beast, as she finds herself removed farther and farther from the council and from the comfort of the council of Mordecai. When Luther was tempted of the devil, if you read the accounts, Luther seemed to be very often tempted of the devil. It would make sense that the devil would take time out from his busy schedule to go after Luther, since at the time Luther almost had a monopoly on the truth. Well, the devil would come to him and tempt him. Luther tells us that he would repeat to himself, "I am baptized, I am baptized." What he was doing is he's reminding himself that he was a Christian. He's reminding himself that he is called to something higher. He's doing this because if you would only remember your identity, you would very less often be overcome by sin. It's when you forget who you are, it's when you forget what you are, that you are most likely to fall prey to the world, the flesh, and the devil. And Luther knew that. And evidently, so did Esther. Because Esther sought here to remember who she was, especially in the eyes of God. She wants to remember she's a Jewess. She belongs to the people of God. She has a special relationship to the tabernacle and to the temple, being related or at least associated with the tribe of Levi. We know, because of what we know about Mordecai, that she was actually of the tribe of Benjamin. And we know that there is some kind of royal lineage in all likelihood that is associated with that. So she's reminding herself. We're being reminded. She's the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai. Abihail is uncle of Mordecai, brother to his father, Jair. Remember that. It was earlier on in the chapter we learned that. Of course, earlier in the chapter, Esther's father had not been mentioned, because he died when Esther was very young, perhaps even before her birth, as I noted then. But her father had been an uncle. And an uncle is like a second father. He'd been an uncle to Mordecai. And from what transpires after his death, we have some reason to believe that he exercised himself in his responsibilities as Mordecai's uncle. That relationship between Mordecai and his uncle was something that actually had meaning in Mordecai's life as well, presumably, as in Abihail's life. And that in time, the duty that Abihail exercised toward his nephew, Mordecai, that that would bear fruit. Because we are also reminded here that Mordecai was the one who had taken her for his daughter. Mordecai had been then like a second father standing in his place. He was standing in the place of Abihail. We see then the importance of family. Because although she was orphaned very young, the fact is this. We discover through these connections that she had been born into a very devout religious family. It was a family which evidently took seriously their covenant obligations, and she very clearly was raised in the faith. What a blessing, then, it is to have others who are willing and spiritually able to maintain your responsibilities in the practice of true religion when you're removed by death. Mordecai had taken her for his daughter. We're told now that when the turn of Esther was come to go in unto the king, Esther's turn was come to go in unto the king. And once more, the Hebrew employs a euphemistic phrase that covers what has been a sordid competition of sorts. And yet, in the turn falling to Esther, we're all ready to anticipate something different. Something distinct is about to occur. After all, unlike all of the others, the book of Esther has given us reason to know both who she is and something of her lineage, her genealogy. But I think most importantly, what we know about Esther is that she was a woman far different from those who preceded her in this competition. You know, all of these other women were driven by a desire. And that desire was to become queen. They were all consumed and had been consumed from the moment they were chosen, when the king sent officers out into the empire to choose among the women, to find the most beautiful women in the empire. To be chosen would set you immediately on this course thinking, I'm going to be the one. I'm going to do it. I'm going to overcome the odds. After all, I already have begun to overcome the odds. So they're driven by this desire to become queen. But in contrast to that, Esther's not driven by some desire to wed some heathen king. Esther's been brought up in the faith, and her desire is actually to glorify God. We know this because she's modest and she's discreet. But I think we also know this from what we're told next. That when her turn was come to go in unto the king, we're told she required nothing but what Haggai the king's chamberlain appointed. So, what this means is this. Unlike the other women, Esther had not been drowned in the luxurious living of the harem. Unlike the other women, Esther was not consumed with the thought of competing with all of these other women. Esther had a very different purpose in going in to the king. Esther had a very different desire in appearing before the king. It's true. She underwent whatever was necessary to come before the king. But, you see, she wasn't driven by vanity. Nor was there any of the desperation in her actions that undoubtedly characterized the actings of all of the other women. They knew it was stiff competition. They knew that they were up against a very, very difficult proposition. One among hundreds. Some commentators think there were thousands that were going before them. I'm not sure that it was that many, but there were certainly hundreds. Now we're told that rather than give license to her own passions, rather than entertaining her own imaginations, rather than thinking she knew what was best, when it was her time to go in unto the king, unlike the others who made requests and were given whatever they wanted, Esther deferred to the minimum which Haggai required. In other words, she was carried into this competition not by a sense of vanity that would be so great that it would overcome these other women. She was carried by a sense of purpose. And she was clad in the appropriate ornaments of the feminine sex, modesty and a quiet spirit. She wasn't loud and boisterous. She didn't in any way seek to intrude her presence into the palace. She waited her turn. She wasn't anyone in any way interested in pressing her claims, as presumably these other women. Instead, she waited upon the Lord. And she trusted in his providence. Now, if you were an outsider observing what was going on, if you saw what Esther did in comparison to what all these other women did, you might think, and it might seem to you, that she was deliberately trying to be disqualified from the position of queen. But to the well-informed reader of the book of Esther, what Esther is doing is displaying that quiet confidence of one who knows she's walking according to the divine counsel. She doesn't need all this other stuff. She doesn't need to trap a man. She doesn't need to put herself out to get his attention. She knows that she is, in fact, walking according to the providence and the preceptive will of God. Now we're told in this verse as well that we're reminded that Haggai, the king's chamberlain, was the keeper of the women. The king's chamberlain, the chief eunuch, he's the one charged with guarding and protecting the women. And I think that this too is somewhat instructive, because whereas the other women had also found themselves in the harem, only Esther appears to have embraced the providence of her disposition. And as she'll appear immediately after in subsequent verses, it's for her alone that Haggai really does provide the guardianship he's been appointed to give. Now the others, They don't resonate with Haggai the way that Esther does. And they don't, I think, because they don't really have that quiet and modest deportment that she has. the discretion and modesty to submit to Haggai as the guardian of the harem has as much to do with Mordecai's care for her and his counsel as she went into the harem. He has counseled her, and she not only knows her place as a female, but she also understands her place in the providence and plan of God. So again, we see in a sort of backhanded way here, I think, the superiority of Mordecai's wisdom, which prepares Esther for improving her present circumstance. And again, in this, she stands apart from the other women. And she really avails herself of Haggai, and he makes himself available to her as a result. You know, the other women are just paying lip service to him. Esther alone is the one who is really falling into her proper place before him. And so we're told then, and Esther obtained favor in the sight of all them that looked upon her. Now, if you want a testament to her feminine modesty and her quiet demeanor, here it is. The other women, think about this, it turns out, because they went in and they went out, they went in and they went out, right? The other women couldn't find enough to take with them. It's obvious because they were failures. And yet Esther here, we're told, she's basically, she's taken the bare minimum. She had actually desired nothing here. And yet, here we're told that she received that which all the other women had failed to achieve. What did they all want? They all wanted what Esther ends up getting. But Esther was not seeking that. All of the women that were seeking that didn't get what they desired, because they didn't seek first the kingdom of God. But Esther was. She obtained favor in the eyes of all who looked upon her. That's incredible. But you know, there is something astonishingly attractive, even to unbelievers, when Christians behave as Christians. And they may not like our words, they may find our stand at various times distasteful to their worldliness. But they're strangely attracted as well as repulsed when you really behave as a Christian. They can't quite shake that inward attraction to the cross. They don't really know what to do with that. There's something that's both noble and dignified in the bearing of Christians when they're faithful to God. Now, I think there are two comments that I came across that are made by the Jews upon this sentence, which I think are worthy of our reflection. The first is this. They actually note from this this sentence, they note that all, the word all here, that Esther obtained favor in the sight of all them that looked upon her, that this must include God and the angels as well. And additionally, they also note that it would have included not only those of her own nation, the Jews, but all other nations. And that really is somewhat unusual from a human point of view. You know, in beauty contests, generally, when they do these international beauty contests, the nations tend to cheer for the women from their own nation. The idea here seems to be that in the end, they're all really cheering for Esther. You know, they may have given up from the women from their own provinces, and they're cheering for her. Of course, as we'll see later, they don't yet know that she's a Jew. But secondly, and I think also of great interest, the Jewish commentators note from the use of the word all here, right, that she obtained favor in the sight of all them that looked upon her, that the book of Esther must be the inspired word of God. Because they reason, how could anyone say that she found favor in the eyes of all except God? I think that's worth contemplating. You know, there are a lot of arguments that people have put forth over the years claiming that because Esther doesn't mention the name of God, it's not inspired, that because Esther, we don't have records of a Queen Esther, that this is maybe at best historical fiction. But there is internal evidence, and I'll point out a little bit more as we go on. There is internal evidence, I think, for the inspiration of the book of Esther. So, verse 16. So Esther was taken unto King Ahasuerus into his house royal in the 10th month, which is the month Tibeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Now the phrase, so Esther was taken unto King Ahasuerus, that does not mean that she was taken forcibly or without her consent. That's not the idea here. All that it really means is that Esther too went in unto the king in her appointed time, and that she was married to Ahasuerus. Now it's interesting, I think, because we've known the identity of the king, but for some time, the fact is the identity of the women, none of them have been mentioned. But finally, we are told of Esther being joined to Ahasuerus, because, as we're going to see, this is a marriage that actually counts for the king. This is where we find the king's interest intersecting with the interest of the people of God. So the others, the memory of the others fades quickly with this encounter with Esther. And they're all just a bunch of pretty faces, but Esther has some other quality that makes her shine where the others just fade. We know, and we're told in verse 14, that many had gone before her, but none had captured the attention of the king until Esther. So we're told she was taken unto King Ahasuerus into his royal house. Now, that implies that not only is she married to him, but there's more than this. She's taken into his royal house, anticipates full disclosure that we find in the next verse. It leads us to believe immediately that Esther, unlike the others, had met with success, where the others had gone in and come out and been consigned to the second house of women. Now, Esther goes in, and she's not consigned to the second house of women. Now, she's actually consigned to the house royal. His royal house. That means she's not going to be consigned to the status of concubine. And that anticipates what we're going to be told in the next verse. Nonetheless, there is this this parenthetical remark, we're told that this occurred in the 10th month. The 10th month would have meant that this was in the middle of the winter. It corresponds to our December, January. Remember, December is the 10th month, actually. October, November, 9th month, October, the 8th month. December the 10th month. Now it's been noted that the number 10 in the Bible represents the perfection of the divine order and even the imposition of divine government. And I think that's accurate. After all, there are 10 commandments. What is that if it's not the perfection of divine order and the imposition of divine government? There are 10 plagues, which again is the effecting of divine order and imposing divine government. There are the 10 horns on the beast. And even the 10 generations from Adam to the flood. Furthermore, in the book of Esther, what we will see is Haman will be hanged along with his 10 sons. So I think this idea seems apt in this case as well. The 10th month then represents the intrusion of the divine government in the Persian Empire. It's the intrusion of the divine order. The 10th month, which is the month Tebeth. Now, this month is actually quite significant. In 597 or 8 BC, Nebuchadnezzar had surrounded Jerusalem on the 10th day of Tebeth. That was the time of the beginning of the siege that led to the destruction of the temple. And because of that, the Jews had actually commemorated the 10th of Tebeth as a fast day. Because it was accounted as the beginning of the destruction of the first temple. It was the beginning of the events which lead up to the destruction, the sacking of the temple, the taking of all of the furniture within the temple, and so on. Now then, with the story of Esther, what we see is this, that the providence of the timing had actually brought her before the king in the very month which was marked by the Jews as the beginning of the destruction of the first temple. And since the rise of Esther leads to the complete rebuilding of the second temple, now let me say this before I go on. The command to rebuild the temple was sometime 539-538 BC by Cyrus. And that actually marked the end of the 70 years of the Babylonian Empire that Jeremiah had talked about. That period that went from around 605 to 539 or so. That period of time, when they started to build the temple, remember, they then stopped for a while. And after Esther, after the death of Xerxes, Ahasuerus, remember he dies in 465 BC, at that point his son Artaxerxes begins to reign. And so under Artaxerxes, first Ezra and then Nehemiah. Ezra about the year 458 BC, Nehemiah about the year 455 BC, they return, and that it's during that time the second temple is actually completed, and the wall around Jerusalem is finished. So this, the rise of Esther here, I think is rightly seen by the Jews to be a fitting bookend, if you will, to the siege and destruction of the temple. Because of Esther, one thing that will happen is the temple furniture that was taken under Nebuchadnezzar is going to be restored to the second temple. Well, they're going to wait till it's finished and the wall around Jerusalem is completed, but because of Esther, that all of that can be restored. So I think it is significant that the month Tebeth is mentioned here. In the month, it's the month Tebeth in the seventh year of his reign. That means several things. You know, seven is a marker of perfection and completion. There is a completion that has occurred here in the reign of Xerxes or Ahasuerus. What it also means, practically speaking, in terms of the book, is the seventh year of his reign means 4 years now had elapsed since Vashti had been removed from the throne. Now, it might seem like Esther had waited an inordinate amount of time since the search for a replacement had begun. But we have to recall that during these intervening years, Ahasuerus had actually been off much of the time on his ill-fated Greek campaign. It's only after he's come back that he begins to ruminate over the loss that he now is sensing with the absence of Vashti. And so the search had only begun earlier in the year, perhaps the end of the previous year. It had only really begun not much more than a year ago. Although we know that many women, again, verse 14 tells us many women had gone before Esther. And yet, we also know, I think, from this, that Esther was far from the end of the line. There were others who could have been considered. Now, I think this, too, shows the wisdom in her waiting on Haggai, the king's chamberlain, the chief eunuch. Because Haggai, she had favor in his eyes, and he wouldn't have preferred her too soon, knowing most assuredly that the earliest contenders are probably going to fail. You got to wait until the king is actually tired of this contest before there's a hope of anyone who's going to be a breakout favorite, right? And yet, from all of this, in this parenthetical remark, what we actually know is this: her turn came at the precise time appointed by Providence, and it had very deep meaning for the Jews. Verse 17. And the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. The king loved Esther above all the women. Here is a declaration that each of the previous women had wished to hear spoken of herself. They all wished that it had been them. And it is kind of amazing. The king had only been looking for the most beautiful in terms of physical charms. However, the hand of Providence had moved his heart to perceive something more in her. I think the verse leads us to believe he's not merely taken with her beauty, although her beauty is assumed. The text tells us that he loved her above all women, found in her a delight that exceeded all the rest of the women who had come before him. Now, I think here, too, we can actually detect the inspiration of the text, because who but God can reveal the secrets of the heart of the king? Although I admit the result of the secret motion is readily apparent, nonetheless, the text tells us in no uncertain terms this is the case. What Esther had far exceeded mere physical beauty. As important as that might seem to the king. Now Solomon, when he was reflecting upon his many wives, concludes that there's hardly one who had the most important thing. In Proverbs 31:10, he says, "Who can find a virtuous woman? For her price is far above rubies." But Ahasuerus knew already from his a short time with her that Esther truly was a virtuous woman. Now, unlike the others, Esther hadn't sought the crown by her own devices. She had, as noted, almost as much as it was possible for her, thrown away that opportunity. Much as she could, she distanced herself from anything remotely resembling a desire to be queen. Her breeding, which is so much the result of Mordecai's care for her when she was growing up, her breeding had shown through in her deportment, as I said earlier. Her modesty and discretion were undoubtedly all times in plain sight of the king. And in all of which, she excelled the others, and the king's heart was knit to hers. Now, the use of the term love here actually contrasts Esther with all the other women who, in verse 14, were told in whom he only took pleasure. That was the best that any of them had achieved. He had taken pleasure in a few. And that wasn't even all of them. But only of Esther's, it said, he loved her. And, we're told, she obtained grace and favor in his sight. Now, we've already heard Esther had obtained favor in the sight of all who had looked upon her. And because she had obtained favor in the sight of God and the angels, as the Jews note, I think it's safe to conclude that it was for this reason she found favor in the eyes of all the others. After all, obtaining God's grace was the key to obtaining the king's grace and all the divine favor that brings with it the favor of men. The phrase that's translated here, she obtained grace, in Hebrew means something more like this. She was lifted up of grace. So the idea of the lifting up of the head. The grace that was in her was that which raised her up in his eyes. And then finally, not only in his eyes, but in the eyes of the entire kingdom as she's advanced to be queen. And this is something which was lacking in all of the others. The word favor means loving kindness. It denotes a certain faithfulness, such as that which God has with his people. It's often translated actually by the word mercy in our authorized version. Psalm 103:17. But the mercy of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting upon them that fear him, and his righteousness unto children's children. The mercy of the Lord. She obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. The king's heart is taken with Esther through her charms to such an extent that we're told it surpassed all the virgins who had preceded her. The sense is not simply that he delighted in her more, which he did, but that he loved her better than all those who had gone before to such an extent he couldn't begin to imagine finding one after her who would be her equal, let alone her superior. With Esther, then, the king's search had reached its conclusion. And so we're told he set the royal crown upon her head. The choice was made, and Ahasuerus places the royal crown. Literally, the term here is the royal turban upon the head of Esther. What she gets is a veil. Her charms and her inner beauty far exceed the outward beauty of any of her competitors. When it comes to Esther, competition has come to an end. King has no further desire to find a queen. Whatever remained in the harem, whoever remained in the harem, they knew at this point they had no chance in this lottery of flesh that was going on. Ahasuerus was decisive in cutting off any hopes by setting a clear contrast between Esther and all the other women. And he does so by adorning her with the royal headdress. He set the royal crown upon her head and he made her queen instead of Vashti. So her status is now secured. The Targum actually says that when this happened, that Ahasuerus took, he had a picture or a statue of Vashti in his bedroom, and he took this picture or statue out and replaced it with one of Esther. Esther is not going to be merely a concubine wife, but the queen. And she prevailed to take the place of Vashti. With that, the contest ceased as abruptly as the occasion of its starting. Remember the removal of Vashti. Very abrupt. I just want to observe a couple of things before I conclude. First of all, consider then the providence of God who ordereth all things in perfection. Esther came in her appointed time, her turn. I told it was her turn. It was a time at which, as I noted, the king had obviously reached his fill of women. Kind of, what that really meant was this, I think. He knew at this point what he didn't want in a queen. Beauty was not enough. Of this, now, I think the king would have been convinced. And so when his heart is prepared providentially, Esther's turn came. And again, as I already noted, it was a time when there was historical resonance for the people of God. Because as I said, the month Tebeth contained the fast day for the siege and fall of Jerusalem. And if you were a devout Jew, you could hardly fail to apprehend in all of this then the hand of God in the timing, and certainly Esther herself would have been aware of this. So this would be a source of great comfort to the people of God long before the enemies of the Jews would even see their deliverance coming. All who were faithful then would have great reason to hope that the timing of this choice would lead to greater deliverances for them. And of course, there's Mordecai outside, walking to and fro. And his heart, when he came to know the timing, he must have rejoiced when he reflected upon the perfection in that divine timing. Now again, we have to remember that favor is something which God alone can give. When men have favor in the eyes of other men, it's clear evidence of the work of God, who works in men by His Spirit what's not there by nature. Fact is that by nature, all men are of the same lump of corrupted coal, clay. They're darkened and blackened, cast down in sin and iniquity. There's nothing good in them. There's nothing really that makes one stand out. But by grace, some men are made to rise above nature. And that is favor. That's the kind of favor we're talking about here. And it's clear. It is remarkable. It's singular. And this is the case of Esther, who was nourished in the fear and admonition of the Lord. She was brought up by Mordecai. She found favor in the eyes of all in the harem. And in the end, she carries a singular stature in the eyes of the heathen king. So of Esther, who though by our account is certainly very beautiful, it may be said, which we find in Proverbs, favor is deceitful and beauty is vain. But a woman that feareth the Lord, she shall be praised. And I would assert that because she did fear the Lord, she had no need to fear what man could do. Because she did fear the Lord, she did not fear the outcome. Because she did fear the Lord, she had nothing to fear when she went before that heathen king. Because every hair of her head was numbered. Every tear was kept in God's bottle. Every prayer that she had offered up was waiting for its fulfillment, and the time had come. Finally, while we should deplore the effeminacy of the king who was addicted to the pleasures of the flesh, and while we should decry the fate of all those women who were made grist for his flesh mill of vanity and lust, we also must admire in all of this the overruling hand of providence, which turned the vices and the weaknesses of a great heathen king to serve the interests of the lowly people of God. Now there, I think, we have a display of divine wisdom. A divine wisdom which is able to bring light out of darkness and good out of evil. And so I'd say, if today, truly, if we would serve the God of Israel, we serve the God of Israel, we serve a great king and a wonderful God to think upon. And that's the God that's held forth to us in Esther. Amen.